National Elevator. This is Bernard McLaughlin.
Good morning. Police and Court, Stephen Kessel on behalf of Defendant Appellant Bernard McLaughlin. I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
ERISA does not permit money judgments. The December 18, 2015 order was a money judgment against him personally. The judge did not have the authority to enter it.
But the action here, the complaint that was filed, is clearly a complaint for equitable relief under ERISA. How did anything that happened thereafter change that?
Well, then when the complaint was for equitable relief under ERISA, the judgment that was entered was not, because
the original judgment was equitable lien.
Yes, it was. The original judgment was an equitable lien, and I took an appeal from that, and I lost that.
Okay. And there was no dispute in that appeal as to what amount of money was at stake.
I'm not sure I would agree with that, Judge. Hmm? The original judgment was for equitable restitution. It did not impose a lien. It certainly didn't adjudicate the amount of the lien.
It says it's an action for the imposition of a constructive trust or equitable lien over identifiable funds, and says it's not an action for a money judgment.
Okay, but the relief governed by ERISA is the order that's entered by the court at the end of the case.
Yeah, but you had to monetize the lien at some point.
If you don't monetize the lien, how do you go after an ephemeral lien that exists out there somehow, but what does it mean?
You certainly have to monetize the lien.
Okay.
But the lien has to be against a specific fund.
Well, not under Funk. Funk was the law then, and clearly under Funk, it didn't have to be.
Well, it could be against someone personally. The second order enters a personal money judgment against Bernie McLaughlin. That's not something the court ever had the authority to do under ERISA. It's a word for bitches. It makes him personally liable, not out of a fund.
But are you saying that Funk, at the time it was decided, are you saying Funk was wrong?
I'm sorry?
At the time Funk was decided, are you saying that it was wrong?
Yes, it was.
Well, it was wrong until Montanil said it was wrong.
Funk also wouldn't control this anyway, necessarily, because Funk did not enter a money judgment against the defendant personally. It allowed a set-off. But that's what happened here. We have a personal judgment against...
But Funk makes clear, and I happen to disagree with it, but it makes clear that you can go after any and all assets of the defendant, the debtor, regardless of whether those assets have been dissipated. Isn't that right? Isn't that the point of Montanil reversing Funk?
Well, I think the Funk was a bit more limited because it addressed only the Social Security disability assets. But, yes, it could be construed that broadly.
Thing I never quite could grasp about that is when I think lien, I think that attaches to a res, right? You have to have
a res.
Of
course it does.
But we're not in that world because we're in a pre-Montanil world in trying to ascertain whether Judge Thompson made the right call based on what she knew at the time she made it, and Montanil had not yet been decided.
The Funk came out after Great West Life was decided, after the earlier cases that all talked about equitable relief only, and there had to be some finding that what the judge did was granting equitable relief. The second order, the December 19th...
You're okay with the first order, then. Your argument is, look, ERISA says no money judgments, and what that means is you can't enter a judgment for equitable lien and then use the auspices of Rule 60 to somehow convert that to a money judgment. Money judgments are and always have been precluded by ERISA.
That's my position on appeal. Now, I'm not okay with the first order because I think that, in effect, Judge Thompson entered contractual restitution as opposed to equitable restitution, but I lost that point. Okay, so I'm not going to argue it here. That's why I petitioned for certification on that issue. But we're not dealing with the January 24th, 2014 order anymore. We're dealing with the December 18th, 2015 order.
All right, and for that to be valid under Rule 60, that has to be just a mechanical adjustment, right?
And this really was not a change.
Well, but why isn't it, if the amount was in dispute, I think you'd be on a better footing there. But my understanding of reviewing the prior appeal is that it was never disputed as to what the number was. And if the number was agreed upon, why isn't that just a mechanical change?
There was no number ever agreed upon. It was not a dispute in the prior appeal because the order and the proof submitted by the plan never brought a specific amount to the judge's attention to be adjudicated.
After our decision affirming summary judgment, I thought the $47,000 level was, I thought it was basically not contested.
Right.
That was the dollar amount.
There were no proofs as to
where was it contested? Regardless of whether there were proofs, where was that number contested?
The first time that amount was ever presented to the district court was when they sent a letter into the court with a printout attached on December 18, 2015. That printout and no amount was ever mentioned to the district court before they sought to reopen the issue. I immediately wrote a letter to the court saying, no, we don't think this is the correct lien because they have sent us letters on prior occasions asserting a lower amount for the lien, I think $37,000. That was one of the initial objections I raised to what they did. And in my motion for reconsideration, I did an issue of the amount of the lien. The amount of the lien was never an issue until we sought to reopen this matter a year after the...
We said that number was not in dispute. You're just saying that panel was incorrect in saying that amount was not in dispute.
I don't know where the panel would have gotten that number. It was never in the record. It's never in the district court's opinion. It's not in any appendices.
That's what we have to work with.
There was some references in letters. You may have seen the correspondence back and forth between me and the plan, and it was that various sums were referenced in those letters. No one number was referenced. But it was simply never a subject of proof.
Did you say, I'm forgetting, when the court entered this order on the Monday after the letter, did you say we dispute the amount?
Yes. I say we dispute the amount, and also in my...
What is your dispute with the amount?
They have sent us prior letters asserting a lien of in the 30s. I think it was $37,000. As opposed to the $47,000 there. I have a feeling that they added amounts that incurred after the liability case is settled, which they weren't in the process in time for the liability case settled. And of course, that would extinguish the lien, because the lien's fixed when the liability case is settled. But it was never a...
I mean, the first paragraph of our opinion, facts in this case are undisputed. In broad summary, then there's a few sentences. The plan thereafter paid approximately $47,580.24 in medical benefits on his behalf. McLaughlin filed personal injury claims against the attorney. In December 2011, the case settled. That is what we have to work with. That's in our prior opinion.
I understand that.
And are you saying you have set-offs? Is that why?
Yeah, the numbers were never set off because...
Did you file a complaint in New Jersey on the set-off?
It's currently pending.
Okay, so then... Okay. Then you might get some money back in that case if we rule against you here, but that doesn't alter the number that Chief Judge McKee just read.
Well, that number was never the subject of a judicial finding. It was something I don't...
It was never the judicial finding. The facts are undisputed.
It was never the subject of a fact finding by the district court. The number was never submitted in the proofs of the district court. The first time I saw that printout in any document attached to a pleading was when they sent the letter in.
You're asking us to basically say that even though we said, the panel here said it's not presidential, the facts are undisputed, you're asking us to conclude that the prior panel was wrong, that we cannot rely upon the figure that you put in your opinion, colleagues, because now we're being told, Judges Window, Greenaway, and Berry, that the facts and the amount was disputed. I'm not sure we can do that.
I'm asking that you not make Bernie McLaughlin personally liable for any amount of money.
That's different than the value of the judgment. That gets to the point, which is you're saying no money judgments under ERISA.
Right.
Irrespective of whether it's $1 or $100,000.
Right. Let me just note, you also said in your brief filed in opposition to the motion for summary judgment that you note, it says, Because there's no need to await issuance of a decree, the holder of an equitable lien by agreement may stand in a better position. Because the amount of lien is agreed to, the amount need not be determined at a separate hearing. I'm citing McCutcheon's in restatement. And it seems to me, you know, that you're taking the position that a lien by agreement isn't subject to dispute.
The lien that was agreed to is they had a lien for all the medical proof. all the medical expenses they paid. That amount was never judicially determined. There's no doubt they have a lien for, they would have had a lien against a qualified fund for any money they did pay for the, to the, on behalf
of the plaintiff. So you would like us to open this up and say, Judge Thompson, have a hearing as to the amount?
I think, I'm asking that you, it would be nice. I mean, I don't think you have to go that far. I think you simply have to, all I'm asking that you do is relieve Bernie McLaughlin of his personal liability for the lien.
But there is really something wrong here also, in that there is an agreement that this money was supposed to go back over to the plan, and the plan paid it.
And it looks like
you've fought this tooth and nail. Are you really saying he doesn't owe this obligation?
No, he only owes it if he got the money back from the tortfeasor. He never did. That's it. That's the.
Did he never get any recovery? I thought you got a settlement from the tortfeasor.
He did get a settlement, but the
settlement. So in the plan, interestingly, the plan doesn't even say that he has to reimburse only medical expenses.
It doesn't matter how.
No matter how it's collected.
That's true. Well, that's what they say, but that's contrary to the idea of equitable restitution.
Well, the problem is, though, it looks like you're not suggesting this is what happened. Maybe I'm suggesting this is what happened. They're arguing it's what happened. The client structured the settlement specifically to avoid having to, quote, honor, close quote, the obligation under his agreement with the plan.
I am under no obligation under ERISA to include medical expenses in my claim on behalf of Bernie McLaughlin. Under state law, I can't even recover them aside from the preemption issue. The claims remedy, if they basically made a gift to Bernie McLaughlin, was the
That's good lawyering. I'm not going to, criticize good lawyering. If you can help protect your client's assets, that's fine. But the fact remains that in this case, the terms of the plan allowed the board to recover from McLaughlin regardless of how we characterize the settlement.
You could
move heaven and earth, call it whatever you want.
And the terms of the
it doesn't help you under the terms of this plan.
And the terms of the plan that say that are contrary to the idea of equitable restitution. They're asking for
So you want us to ignore the terms of the plan?
To the extent they ask for a contract remedy as opposed to an equitable remedy, yes, you're required to.
What case supports that? What case supports reading this anyway other than the way it's read? In fact, the case law repeatedly says this is the way it should go.
No, not since that's very clearly their remedies are limited to equitable restitution.
What transforms this from equitable restitution into legal restitution? Are you saying because there's no identifiable fund that's there, therefore it must be legal and not equitable?
It's legal restitution because the only basis for the claim is by looking at what's in the plan as opposed to looking at the nature of what my client recovered. For equitable restitution, I have to have something that...
You have to have a fund, identifiable fund.
That's the legal issue, not the restitution issue. For equitable restitution, I have to have something that unjustly enriches me and belongs in good conscience to them. If I don't have that, I have nothing to give to them on equitable restitution claim.
Why doesn't that arise from what was just read to you about this? It flows from a legal obligation, a contractual obligation. But if that flows from a legal obligation, equitably, why wouldn't equity impress something in the nature of a trust upon recovery?
Because they can't point to anything beside the plan language giving the right to the money. The only thing your question is what the plan says. That's not the proper inquiry.
But under U.S. Airways versus McCutcheon, the agreement provides a measure of equities.
It provides a measure of equities, not the existence. An analogous situation would be a plaintiff in a breach of contract action who has a liquidated damages clause who had no real damages.
We won't say where we think the equities might lie here. Who knows? A lot of it depends on how you characterize what happened here. Whether it's a monetizing of the lien. Or a personal judgment. That's a very difficult issue for us to decide. Looks like she's monetizing the lien.
Well,
because saying here we come pursuant to this, this is the amount.
The difference is that in the earlier order, if it took it to a clerk and wanted to docket it as a personal judgment against Bernie McLaughlin, they couldn't do it. In the second order, they can do that. It becomes a personal judgment. It can be docketed.
That's what Funk says. You don't have to have the same property. You can get it out of his assets.
But you can't get it from him personally. And when you docket it, they can execute upon it.
Personally? I would think so.
And they can't. Well, the problem is they can't do that because it's not against the lien. And to the extent that Funk said you could get evidence personalis, Funk was overruled by the
state. But late. But we can't apply Montanil at this point.
You don't have to. You can apply Great West Life, and you can apply the cases that came before Montanil. This is
Montanil was the controlling law.
Funk was the controlling law.
I mean, Funk was the controlling law.
It was in the circuit, but it was contrary to
the Supreme Court. That's
where we are. But Funk was contrary to what the Supreme Court has said.
What?
Okay, I have a red light now, so.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Hoover?
Thank you, Your Honors. John Kolb, I'm here for the Board of Trustees for the National Elevator Industry Health Benefit Plan. And this case, to me, is we're talking about some pretty complicated issues, but it all comes down to really a simple question, and that is, when Judge Thompson entered in her original order on January 24, 2014, did she intend for the plan to be able to recover the money that it paid? Because we know that there was a mistake made on the judgment. What was listed was a proposed summary judgment that would have been listed like on a defense claim, where it merely said summary judgment is granted to the plaintiff in the case.
Well, I don't know whether it's the original intent or whether it's what happened when the letter was sent and an actual judgment was entered. I mean, one thing going against your side of the argument is that that letter that was sent asked for a judgment in a certain amount, never referred to an equitable lien, never referred to Rule 60, and what she said was recover this dollar amount and enter a personal judgment. I mean, I think that's where you have an issue. And how should we characterize that? I think that's the issue. What would help us characterize it in your way, that is, that this was merely an equitable lien, a lien by agreement, rather than a personal judgment?
Well, the complaint listed, as you mentioned before, Judge Rendell, the complaint only asked for an equitable lien by agreement.
Right.
That's what the judgment would have been issued at the time.
And that's what you got with the first order. You got the court saying, yes, you're entitled to this lien by agreement.
Well, we have the opinion, but the judgment that was issued didn't specify anything. It didn't specify the amount of the lien. It just simply said summary judgment is granted to the plaintiff in the case.
Right. But my point is, if you then later had filed asking for a hearing as to the amount of the equitable lien or the amount of the lien by agreement, I maybe had a hearing on it, that might have been easier. And then she enters an equitable lien amount. That would have been cleaner and more apparent.
Absolutely. That would have been more artful. Of course, at the time, there was an appeal going on the original judgment for the arguments that were made that there was a petition for certiorari that came later. And then it was at the time, after settlement talks broke down, that we realized, okay, we're going to have to figure out how to enforce this. And that's the time that we went back to the court and said, Judge, there was a what happened is the original judgment did not list the amount that we need in the sum certain, so can you please enter a judgment that does?
I assume the judge relied upon this catch-all provision. Rule 60, you didn't specify what provision you were asking for relief on, did you?
We did not specify that, no. And, of course, Rule 60 allows the judge the discretion to correct an error in a judgment
but
like that.
But there was no error here. It was something that needed to be done. And, quite frankly, it seems to me it probably should have been done on notice and opportunity for answer. But there's no reference to Rule 60 in either your submission or her order.
That is correct. It's not mentioned. Of course, Moore's federal practice allows, it specifies when it talks about Rule 60A specifically that it's not just limited to correct, clerical errors and that type of error, but it's allowed that a district judge has the discretion to invoke Rule 60 to resolve any ambiguity in the order more clearly reflect contemporaneous intent or to ensure that the court's purpose was fully implemented.
Yeah, I'm just not sure that setting the dollar amount fits into that category, especially if it is disputed.
You do agree, do you not, that ERISA does not allow for personal money judgments.
As after the Supreme Court in Montanil has ruled, I think that equitable liens are limited to specific funds or assets traceable to those funds.
That was my question. My question was, you would agree, would you not, that ERISA does not allow for personal money judgments?
It does not. So the
type of... It's not a trick question. Does ERISA allow for personal money judgments or not?
In certain situations, it does, Your Honor, and I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm trying to answer the question.
In situations like, in cases like this, it does?
In cases where there is an equitable lien by agreement, we know now it no longer does. But there are things like accounting for profit. There are other things that come down to...
What does that have to do with this? How does this case involve accounting for profit?
Those are just types of relief that would be available under 502A3 of ERISA.
All right, which is not implicated here.
502A3 is the mechanism, the appropriate equitable relief that we're seeking to enforce the equitable lien.
But I'm not asking about equitable relief. I'm asking about a personal money judgment. Let me ask it a different way. In this case, could the plan have sued Bernard McLaughlin and had a prayer for relief that said that the plan hereby demands a judgment against Bernard McLaughlin in the amount of $47,000? Could you have done that?
No.
All right, then how is it proper that you can go to a judge and say, we ask for an equitable lien against Bernard McLaughlin, and then turn around a short time later and then convert that equitable lien into the very same personal money judgment which exposes his assets, wherever they may be found, to execution, when you couldn't do that in the first instance?
Because the argument was, at the time, and what was accepted not just by this circuit in Funk, but also five other circuits at the time, was that when you had an equitable lien by agreement over property, and that property was then dissipated so that it no longer existed, that the courts, in equity, had the power to issue alternative compensation, even through judgment.
Okay, so as I understand your argument, your argument is that you can't just pursue a money judgment in the first instance in a case like this, but what you can do is, when you're getting the runaround in attempting to execute on your equitable lien, then the court retains the equitable powers to help you collect on your equitable lien.
That is correct. And the question that was answered in Montanil is, when the courts were doing that, were they exercising a form of equitable power that they had, or were they exercising illegal relief under a cleanup doctrine?
Right.
Unfortunately for my client, the Supreme Court came down on the idea that they were exercising the cleanup doctrine, and that was not equitable relief. But at the time that it existed, when we got the original judgment, that was the thing that was available.
Okay,
thank you. I assume that your green light is on.
Yes, green light's on, but if there's no other questions, I'm...
Okay.
That's just a question for me, I'll submit.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Could we just see counsel for a second? Can you approach the bench?